This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker. It's a Monday. I'm joined by Ash Sarkar. Ash, how are you doing? Refreshed from the weekend?
You know what? I'm actually a bit sleepy, but maybe while you introduce the first story, I'll just give myself an adrenaline shot in the leg and see how that goes.
We're giving Ash pretty much the first 20 minutes off this show because we are going to be focusing all on Scotland, as you will imagine. I've got a couple of great guests. Also tonight, the Home Office have launched a shock operation to detain asylum seekers ahead of the local elections. We'll be looking at Jamie Driscoll's chances of clinching the North East mayoralty and the curious case of the missing LBC host. Let's go straight into our first story. Humza Yousaf has today resigned as Scotland's first minister after only 13 months in office.
Last week, I stood here to announce the ending of the cooperation agreement between the SNP and the Greens, the Bute House Agreement, and that the SNP would seek to govern as a minority government. I made that decision as leader of the SNP, as I believed ending the Bute House Agreement was the right one for the party I lead. And I still do believe that to be the case. But most importantly, I believe it was the right decision for the country. My hope was to continue working with the Greens in a less formal arrangement as the SNP moved into a new phase of minority government. Unfortunately, in ending the Bute House Agreement in the manner that I did, I clearly underestimated the level of hurt and upset that caused Green colleagues. For a minority government to be able to govern effectively and efficiently, trust when working with the opposition is clearly fundamental. And while a route through this week's motion of no confidence was absolutely possible, I am not willing to trade my values and principles or do deals with whomever simply for retaining power. Therefore, after spending the weekend reflecting on what is best for my party, for the government, and for the country I lead, I've concluded that repairing our relationship across the political divide can only be done with someone else at the helm.
So that was Humza Yousaf saying he could have survived a no confidence vote, but didn't want to engage in the horse trading that winning such a vote might require. He's therefore resigned. Let's quickly remind you of the events that led us to this point. So the Bute House Agreement referred to there by Humza Yousaf was signed by the SNP and the Greens in 2021. So it was a cooperation agreement, slightly short of a full coalition. And it committed the two parties to cooperate on key policy areas while making two Green MSPs ministers in the Scottish government. Now, that agreement was signed while Nicola Sturgeon was leader, but it was reaffirmed by Humza Yousaf when he replaced her in 2023. What did the deal contain? Well, it included a commitment to increasing tenants' rights, investment in public transport, and gender recognition reform. And it held together reasonably well until 11 days ago, when the SNP's Net Zero and Energy Secretary said this.
In this challenging context of cuts, UK backtracking, we accept the CCC's recent rearticulation that this Parliament's interim 2030 target is out of reach. We must now act to chart a course to 2045 at a pace and a scale that is feasible, fair and just.
The SNP's abandonment of their pledge to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 75% by 2030 infuriated Green Party members. And shortly after the Greens announced they would grant their members a vote on whether to quit the party's power-sharing deal with the SNP. The co-leaders of the Green Party actually said that they would campaign to continue the Bute House agreement. But that wasn't enough for Humza Yousaf. He preempted a Green Party vote by unilaterally ending the SNP-Green cooperation deal. Now, this was Yousaf speaking last Thursday.
The Bute House agreement was intended to provide stability to the Scottish Government. And it's made possible a number of achievements. But it has served its purpose. It's no longer guaranteeing a stable arrangement in Parliament. The events of recent days have made that clear. And therefore, after careful consideration, I believe that going forward, It is in the best interests of the people of Scotland to pursue a different arrangement.
The different arrangement that Yusuf had in mind would have been an SNP minority government with him at the helm. But he had failed to account for the anger his decision would cause among Green MSPs, as he admitted really today in his resignation speech. And when both Labour and the Tories tabled no confidence motions in Yusuf, the Greens said they would support it. So it was to avoid that no confidence vote that Yusuf resigned. And in sum, this appears to be a gamble by the First Minister that well and truly backfired. So he said, the Green Party, if you're going to be sort of voting on whether to leave this agreement, I'm going to, you know, go ahead of you and I'm going to sort of call your bluff. I'm going to leave it, right? It clearly backfired. And it's a sequence of events that has clearly taken an emotional toll. And this was the end of Yusuf's speech this morning.
Politics can be a brutal business. It takes its toll on your physical and mental health. Your family suffer alongside you. I am in absolute debt to my wonderful wife, my beautiful children, and my wider family for putting up with me over the years. I'm afraid you will be seeing a lot more of me from now. You are truly everything to me. And although, of course, as you can tell, I'm sad that my time as First Minister is ending, but I am so grateful, I'm so blessed for having the opportunity that are afforded to so few to lead my country. And who could ask for a better country to lead than Scotland? Thank you very much.
First Minister, have you left the party in a worse state than you found it?
So Yusuf's gamble clearly backfired and he has now paid the price. But the Greens haven't come out unharmed either. It was a proposed vote among their members that led Yusuf to end the Bute House agreement. The Greens are now out of government, and it's not clear how they might re-enter it anytime soon. Earlier today, I spoke to Ross Greer. He's an influential Green MSP, and I asked him whether he regrets the role the Greens played in Humza Yusuf's downfall.
The events of the last week are incredibly unfortunate, not just for the parties involved in the government, but for anybody who wants a more progressive, a fairer, greener, a more left-wing Scotland. For the last 2.5 years, the Scottish government has had the most left-wing, the most progressive policy platform that any government in the UK has had for decades. We've raised taxes on those on the highest incomes. We've redistributed to those who needed the most. We've lifted children out of poverty. We were delivering rent controls. We were delivering huge amounts of action on the climate. So the events of the last week are desperately sad. Now, I certainly wanted the Bute House agreement between the SNP and the Greens to continue. But the point at which Humza Yusuf ended the agreement was the point at which he ended a confidence agreement. So the logical conclusion of that is that the Greens no longer had confidence in him. We simply didn't know how he was intending to govern. But the clear signal was intending to govern without us, ending the agreement with us, was only going to be a lurch to the right towards the more conservative forces who had been putting a huge amount of pressure on him, both from within the SNP, but external forces as well, the landlord lobby, the oil and gas industry, large landowners in Scotland. All these forces were aligned against what we were doing in government. And unfortunately, in a massive miscalculation, Humza Yusuf thought that he could somehow continue and continue having our support after having removed the Greens from the government and clearly shifting away from the policy agenda that was the basis of our participation in the first place.
We could go back a few days earlier though, right? So I'm sort of thinking specifically of the decision by the Green Party to allow its members to vote on whether to keep the Bute House agreement. Now, I presume that Humza Yusuf saw that as somewhat of a humiliation, sort of his future being determined by members of a smaller, different party. Do you think that in retrospect, the Greens might have, you know, tried harder to not allow that vote to go forward?
The Scottish Greens, like all Green parties across the UK, are a democratic party. It's quite sad in a lot of ways that we're the last genuinely democratic political parties. Green MSPs were in the Scottish government because our members gave us the mandate to do so. 83-ish% of our members approved the Bute House agreement in the first place. So when the SNP invited us to join the Scottish government. And when we came to that agreement, they knew who they were inviting. They were inviting a Democratic Party, and ultimately it was our members who drive these decisions, the party leadership, MSPs like myself. We have some ability to make decisions, but ultimately we collectively as a party make these decisions. And I'm just like any other party member, I was going to have one vote at that general meeting. Now, I'm confident at that meeting, our members would have voted probably quite comfortably to stay in the Bute House agreement. If it was a question of strong leadership, though, I think this idea that the only option Hamza Yousaf had was to preempt our vote by removing us from the government and that demonstrated strength, well, clearly that was a massive miscalculation. Surely, genuinely strong leadership would have been to say, it's up to the Greens as the junior partner in this government whether they stay or go. He did clearly and repeatedly say he wanted us to stay before he changed his mind. But strong leadership would have been to say that the SNP won the last election. They had a mandate to govern, whether it was as a majority government with the Greens or as a minority, that they would continue doing so. He would continue pursuing his policy agenda. What happened was unfortunately the opposite of strong leadership, and I'm sure it's a source of immense regret to everybody. But Hamza Yousaf was bounced into making that decision. Nobody really thought that he had gradually come to the conclusion that the agreement had to end, because 48 hours beforehand he'd been saying the absolute opposite. But we all know that there were very strong forces within the SNP and externally who'd been trying for a long time to have the agreement end. And yeah, they absolutely seized on the opportunity of our members having that general meeting to decide on our role in the government. We can, and we wouldn't and shouldn't have done anything about that. We are ultimately a democratic party. If Green parties aren't internally democratic, then they're not really Green parties anymore. And the SNP knew that when they invited us to join the government in the first place. That's always been how we've operated.
And the SNP now will elect a new leader. How are the Greens going to play this? I mean, would you consider going into coalition or signing a cooperation agreement with the next SNP leader? Do you have a preference as to who the next SNP leader might be?
I don't think there's any prospect of a formal agreement now between the Scottish Greens and the SNP for the remainder of this parliament. We had that agreement. It was the Bute House agreement. It had the overwhelming support of Green and SNP members. And it was a really, really progressive policy platform, by far the most progressive thing any government in the UK was doing at the moment. Just a couple of weeks ago, the co-leader of the Scottish Greens, in his role as a government minister, Patrick Harvey, published the bill that we're not quite sure what the status of it is now, but that would have delivered a permanent system of rent controls for Scotland and a massive expansion of rights for tenants. The Greens are now out of the government. We don't know what the status of that bill is, but that was a very clear example of something that the Greens had brought in to the government's policy platform. Historically, rent controls were opposed by the SNP, but it was one of the points that they were able to come to agreement with us on in the first place. That agreement has now been ended. It will ultimately be up to the next leader of the SNP what their policy platform actually is and to what extent elements of the Bute House agreement are maintained. From opposition, the Greens will continue fighting for this. So from opposition, we will continue fighting on the housing bill in particular to make sure that that's not watered down and that does progress through Parliament and is passed, because delivering rent controls and expanding rights for tenants, those were priorities for our members. That was a really important part of the mandate we had to go into government. It is clearly going to have to be on an issue-by-issue basis now, though. The prospect for any formal agreement between the parties has been scorched by the events of the last couple of weeks. But we've been here before. I was an opposition MSP in the last session. The Greens were in opposition. The SNP were a minority government. And on an issue-by-issue basis, we did come to agreements with them, most notably on budgets. On other areas, they were able to go to other parties for support. The challenge they've got is the other parties, the three unionist parties, the Conservatives, Labour and the Lib Dems, are much, much more hardened in their opposition to the SNP now than they ever have been before. And that was part of the challenge that Hamza Yousaf found himself in last week. He ended the confidence agreement that gave him a majority and found that, amazingly enough, the party, the Greens, that he had just ended that agreement with weren't particularly inclined to have confidence in him anymore. And no opposition party was willing to do so either.
That was Ross Greer speaking to me earlier. I was eating a little bit of bread while I was watching that video, which I'm going to swallow now. Focus in Scotland will now move on to the contest within the SNP to replace Hamza Yousaf as First Minister. Now, one obvious candidate for the job would be Kate Forbes, who only narrowly lost out to Yusuf in the leadership contest last year. But today, a different frontrunner has emerged, party veteran John Swinney.
I'm giving very careful consideration to standing to be the leader of the SNP. I've been somewhat overwhelmed by the requests that have been made of me to do that, with many, many messages from many colleagues across the party. So I'm giving that issue very active consideration, and it's likely I'll have more to say about that in the days to come.
I've now swallowed it, but I just want to make sure that the remnants of bread have gone from my teeth. To discuss what's next for politics in Scotland, I'm joined now by editor of The National, Laura Webster. Laura, thank you for joining me. And to begin, apparently bookies have stopped taking bets on John Swinney to be the next leader of the SNP because they think it's such a surefire thing. What's his story?
So John Swinney has been around in Holyrood since it was relaunched post-devolution in the late 90s. So he's considered a very safe pair of hands. In fact, the amount of times I've heard him referred to as safe hands Swinney today, I could not actually count. John was Deputy First Minister. He's been in a whole range of cabinet positions. He was COVID Recovery Secretary. He was Education Secretary as well. So he's kind of known for getting on with everybody, not really being a associated with any factions and not really having any major scandals or dramas. And I think the SNP might be quite keen to bring him in to avoid having any more problems along the road to the general election this year.
Is it your analysis that Hamza Yusuf has just really screwed this up? I mean, it does seem like there was a sequence of events that he could have chosen whereby he would still be first minister. But, you know, it's almost difficult to explain his actions over the past week.
It's an almighty mess. I mean, there's no getting around that at all. This time last week, I was in the Scottish Parliament and there was some discussions about, you know, various problems that were affecting the parties, the pro-independence movement. But we were just a couple of days off quite a big independence march through Glasgow, the Believe in Scotland rally, which was led by First Minister and the Greens as well, which seems like a scene that we probably won't see for quite a time now, considering no one is really working together in the independence movement. Yeah, it's hard to say why Hamza made the decisions that he made. I think Ross Grier was touching on the view that maybe he was trying to bring some of the more pro-business, kind of slightly more right-wing people back into the fold of the SNP. But it seems quite obvious that this would have happened. Also, when I was in Parliament last week, there was already some conversations around no confidence votes being put forward. At the time, there was one being put forward in Lorna Slater from ALBA, but nobody had signed it. And so there was speculation that perhaps the Conservatives were putting forward something else. And it seems quite absurd that the SNP leadership did not anticipate that and then see what was coming down the road. The whole thing is obscene, to be honest. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of anger within the SNP. There's a lot of anger within the Greens. There's a lot of anger within the wider independence movement because it feels like, yes, we had issues, but this seems to have blown everything out of all proportion. And it's hard to see how we get back on track from here. I mean, don't get me wrong, support for independence is still there. Despite the SNP declining over the last year, independence is still roughly like half and half. But it's certainly not helping the independence cause. It feels like over the past year, we've made absolutely no further progress.
I understand everyone's going to be pretty annoyed in the independence movement. The Labour Party are going to be rubbing their hands. You know, they're going to be delighted at this. Is this one of, I suppose, many missteps by the SNP? We haven't even mentioned that Nicola Sturgeon's husband and the former chair of the party has been charged recently, hasn't he? So, I mean, the SNP seems to have absolutely imploded. Do you think now the Labour Party could become, once again, the dominant party in Scotland?
Well, Scottish Labour have a lot to do before they can form a majority at Holyrood, that's for sure. I think we have to remember that the Scottish Parliament was built on the basis of minority governance in the first place. That's really important. So this is not like a totally bizarre situation where the SNP are running the government as a minority. It's basically how it's supposed to work. So we've had this happen multiple times before. So it's an interesting situation.
In terms of what happens next, and I suppose whether this government can, well, whoever leads it, you know, whether the SNP can hold off a new Hollywood election until I think it's 2026, isn't it? They'll need support from other parties in Hollywood. Where do you think that's likely to come from? And will that impact sort of the election now for the SNP's leader? Do you think one reason that John Swinney seems to be the favourite is because he's going to be the least offensive to the Alaba party and the Green Party?
John Swinney is kind of the least offensive figure to everybody. So I feel like that's part of a strategy to appeal to all parties in Holyrood, and certainly kind of harkens back to that time of devolution, Alex Salmond as First Minister, where maybe the parties were more willing to work together. I think that John will be able to work with others. And I think the Greens probably will be more likely to work with John. They obviously had this problem with Hamza particularly. Labour and the Tories, they are already entrenched in their views in Holyrood at the moment. It's extremely divided. It's probably the most divided the parliament has been. So it is hard to see them really coming around to like an SNP budget, for instance. But as Ross was talking about earlier on the show, the Greens actually supported several Scottish budgets before when the SNP were in minority government. And in fact, they managed to get policies like the free bus travel for under 22s put forward while they were in opposition. So yeah, we'll see what happens. But just touching back on what you were saying about Scottish Labour, I think what people have to remember here is that Scottish Labour, even if we were to have a Holyrood election tomorrow, for instance, we can't find a First Minister and there's 28 days and then we have an election, which is what the law would state. The Scottish Labour would really struggle to get anywhere close to forming a majority government in the Scottish Parliament. And they would have to rely on some kind of confidence and supply deal with the Lib Dems, or maybe even work with the Conservatives. That might sound kind of unbelievable, but we have several Scottish councils here that have got Labour-Tory coalitions running them. So it's absolutely not out of the question. I just don't know how good that would look going into a general election, where Labour's biggest kind of criticism here in Scotland is that they're far too much like the Conservative Party.
All incredibly interesting. Laura Webster, thank you so much for joining us again on Navarra Live. I'm sure we'll be speaking to you again as this sort of leadership race goes on, although I suppose it could, you know, maybe it'll be over before it started. Ash, I've got a really important question to you. Have you ever timed how long it takes to swallow a mouthful of bread? Much longer than I'd imagined. I put it in about, I put the mouthful in about 60 seconds before we were going back live, and I barely swallowed a third of it.
So I've got some questions for you on this matter of bread. What kind of bread was it? Was it a seedy bread? Was it white bread? Was it a sourdough bread?
It was a tiger baton from Sainsbury's.
So what I would say often about those Sainsbury's kind of white breads is that they form this sort of, it's a consistency that I would liken to like Play-Doh or Blue Tack. So as much as you masticate it, it doesn't seem to be breaking down and becoming more swallowable. And worst of all, it can form this sort of, you know, perfect oyster shape, which becomes glued to the roof of your mouth. And you've got to do this sort of insane cat maneuver to try and dislodge it. So having a mouthful of tiger baton 60 seconds before having to do a piece to camera, you truly live on the edge.
That was a phenomenal description of what I was going through. And I suppose a reminder, there are worse things than being caught masticating on air. Next story. The Government Safety of Rwanda Bill was pushed through Parliament last week, which Rishi Sunak hopes will have cleared the last major hurdle to sending asylum seekers to Rwanda. And with local elections taking place later this week, the Prime Minister is wasting no time making headlines. According to The Guardian, the Home Office has launched a shock operation to detain asylum seekers who qualify for deportation to Rwanda. They say that Home Office officials plan to hold people as they attend routine immigration appointments across the country. Detainees will then be immediately transferred to detention centres, where they'll be held until they're able to be put onto flights to Kigali, so Rwanda's capital, perhaps as soon as this summer. And the action is expected to last for the next 2 weeks, but lawyers have warned that it's likely to lead to protracted legal battles. And in Scotland, police have been put on alert over fears communities will resist detentions. Now, that happened in May 2021 when mass protests in Glasgow blocked the detention of one asylum seeker who'd been living in the community. Similar actions took place in Nicholson Square, Edinburgh, a year later with hundreds of people surrounding Home Office vehicles to block asylum seeker removals. Now, speaking to The Guardian, Glasgow-based human rights lawyer Amar Anwar said this about the Home Office's operation. I suspect in the coming days we will see an explosion of the spirit of Kenmore Street across the UK, opposing a policy that will lead to misery, self-harm and death, driving so many more into the arms of people smugglers. The fundamental question for the Scottish Government as well as Police Scotland is whether they are willing to engage in this barbaric abuse of power against a desperate people. Charities have also expressed concern for the well-being of those affected by the shock operation. Chief Executive of NGO Freedom from Torture, Sonia Skeets, told the BBC this. Make no mistake, this latest attack on refugees by the government will further traumatise people who have fled from torture chambers seeking safety and a chance to rebuild their lives in the UK. We know from our clinical services that even survivors of torture who are completely safe from harm tend to live in a semi-permanent state of hypervigilance to threats because of their history of being rounded up, detained and abused in authoritarian states. So news of this crackdown is sure to trigger mental health collapse in many men, women and children in the care of our therapists. I'm asked for comment. A government spokesperson said this. The government is entering the final phase of operationalising this landmark policy to tackle illegal migration and stop the boats. At some stage, inevitably, this will include detaining people in preparation for the first flight, which is set to take off to Rwanda in 10 to 12 weeks. It would be inappropriate to comment further on operational activity. Ash, I mean, one of the things that stands out to me here is it seems somewhat strange to sort of broadcast that when people come to their routine meeting with the Home Office, you know, to say we're still here, we haven't absconded yet, you know, an arbitrary number of them will be detained so that they can be put onto to a flight to Rwanda. Now, that seems to me like a recipe to encourage people to abscond. And I'm not sure what's going on there. Is it the case that the government thinks, well, if they abscond, then it's going to be easier to deport them anyway? So it's a win-win for them. They just wanted the headline. What's your analysis of what's going on here?
What I'd say is that it's been very clear from the start that what the government really wants from the Rwanda scheme isn't a coherent and workable policy for dealing with asylum seekers. What they want are headlines. And for me, it's a sort of interesting feature of neoliberalism that the government has willfully hollowed out its own capacity to do stuff by handing over more and more responsibilities to the market. So, you know, okay, well, we're not going to take responsibility for making sure that there are like good, well-paid jobs anymore. We're not going to take responsibility for, you know, sewage not being pumped directly into rivers. The one area of policy that the government has really, really held on to is being nasty to asylum seekers, which is itself quite distinct from the actual numbers of immigrants in any given society, because again, that's a bit more dictated by, you know, GDP and the need to like keep our stagnant economy afloat. But this is one area that the government has held on to, I think, as a way of almost justifying its own existence. So there are times where doing the crackdown and getting the plaudits versus actual, you know, efficiency in dealing with the, you know, so-called problem of asylum seekers. These two things are in conflict, and doing the thing that demonstrates that the government is doing something, I think, often wins out. So you're right. When you're putting it out there that an arbitrary number of people will be detained and possibly deported to Rwanda when they're doing their state-mandated check-ins, that's a recipe for absconding. And the thing about asylum seekers absconding is that there's a pretty sizable grey economy to disappear into, particularly if you're a young man rather than, you know, a family of asylum seekers, you know, a woman with children, where it's obviously a lot harder to do that kind of thing. So it's a recipe for a Home Office disaster, but it's a way of, I think, appearing tough and also looking like you're doing something when the Rwanda scheme itself has been so stymied at every stage of actually implementing it, and probably will be again when you think about the individual appeal cases which will be lodged on the behalf of asylum seekers who are told to board that flight. So I think that it's, in your words, you know, chasing headlines. But remember what Suella Braverman said when she was Home Secretary and talking to, I believe it was Christopher Hope, who was then at the Telegraph. She said that what she dreams of is a front page on the Telegraph, and that should tell you everything you need to know about what immigration policy is directed towards.
Let's talk about another aspect of this story, because the Home Office's detention operation comes in the context of debate over whether the Rwanda scheme is already putting asylum seekers off settling in the UK. Ireland's Deputy Taoiseach last week claimed that the UK policy was causing an influx of asylum seekers to his country. According to the Irish government, 80% of recently arrived migrants have entered Ireland via the border with Northern Ireland, or entered the Republic of Ireland via the border with Northern Ireland. Now, that's a claim Prime Minister Rishi Sunak was asked about on Sky News.
Ireland's Deputy Prime Minister says that many of the people who are coming across in these boats are finding their way into Ireland. Are we simply exporting the problem now? Is that the deterrent?
Well, my focus is on the United Kingdom and securing our borders. But what that comment illustrates is a couple of things. One, that illegal migration is a global challenge, which is why you're seeing multiple countries talk about doing third country partnerships, looking at novel ways to solve this problem, and I believe will follow where the UK has led. But what it also shows, I think, is that the deterrent is, according to your comment, already having an impact because people are worried about coming here, and that demonstrates exactly what I'm saying. If people come to our country illegally but know that they won't be able to stay, they're much less likely to come, and that's why the Rwanda scheme is so important.
So as you can see, Sunak thinks that a hostile environment pushing asylum seekers into Ireland is a sign of the policy's success. But Ireland's Taoiseach Simon Harris isn't celebrating.
Every country is entitled to have its own migration policy, but I certainly don't intend to allow anybody else's migration policy affect the integrity of our own one. And this country will not in any way, shape or form provide a loophole for anybody else's migration challenges. That's very clear. Other countries can decide how they wish to advance migration. From an Irish perspective, we intend to have a firm rules-based system where rules are in place, where rules are enforced, and where rules are seen to be enforced.
Ireland has said they want to start returning migrants who cross the border from the UK. And until recently, they did have a returns agreement with Britain. The problem for the Irish government is that in March this year, their High Court ruled that that agreement was unlawful. Harris has therefore said his government will pass new legislation to get returns back up and running. But now the UK government has different ideas. This was Rishi Sunak speaking to ITV's Robert Peston today.
Can you get a return scheme with Ireland, do you think?
I'm not interested in that. We're not going to accept returns from the EU via Ireland when the EU doesn't accept returns back to France where illegal migrants are coming from. Of course we're not going to do that. I'm determined to get our Rwanda scheme up and running because I want a deterrent. I want it to be the case.
So is there a negotiation with the EU that this could be part of?
No. Okay. I'm focused squarely on getting our Rwanda scheme up and running. I want the deterrent, which will say that if you come to our country illegally, you will not be able to stay and you will be removed, either to your own country if it's safe or Rwanda. That's why I've worked so hard at this. That's why we've done all the prep work for this. And actually, I want that deterrent up and running and I'm confident that it will work.
So Sunak is actually going to be absolutely delighted with this situation. So one of the things that Britain has said it's frustrated about is that France won't accept returns of people who have crossed the channel. Now, as we talked about before on the show, when we were within the EU, the Dublin Agreement meant that we would have been able to by law, return people to France. We can't do that anymore because of Brexit. France have no incentive to agree to that. But Rishi Sunak now thinks that potentially he has some leverage over the EU because the asylum seekers that now might want to leave the UK because they're at risk of deportation to Rwanda here are going to Ireland. Rishi Sunak can say, well, I'm only going to take those people back if you take people back to France. So they are going to be really happy with this situation. The Irish less so. I mean, that's because just as in the UK, migration is a fraught issue for the Irish government. The country has recently seen a surge in asylum applications with more than 13,000 people applying for protection in 2022 and 2023. So more than 13,000 a year in those 2 years. Now, that's a fivefold increase compared to 2018. And you can see it's much lower in all years until the last 2 years. Alongside that rise, there has been a surge in anti-migrant activity. Last Thursday night, six people were arrested in County Wicklow after a proposed migrant reception centre in Newtown, Mount Kennedy, was set alight by angry residents. It's the latest in a series of arson attacks at buildings earmarked for migrants. An organised far right is likely to be a driver of the backlash, but no doubt they would have been helped by the fact that Ireland seems to have been little prepared for the increased movement of people to its shores. Over 100,000 people now live in temporary migrant accommodation across Ireland, and there are currently 1,700 asylum seekers sleeping in tents on the streets of Dublin alone. Ash, I suppose this adds a sort of different angle to this story, because, you know, I suppose sometimes people can maybe sort of get in their heads that, oh, the UK government is particularly cruel when it comes to asylum seekers and everyone else is sort of getting on with it. But this sort of competitive politics of who can push their asylum seekers to which country, I think, is potentially going to be an increasing reality in Europe. I suppose within the European Union, they do it in negotiations in the European Union. To be honest, it is already an issue in Europe. If you look at sort of Hungary, Italy, Germany, for example. I mean, what's your thoughts on this?
That was exactly the same thing that I was thinking, which is that this is going to be an increasing feature of European politics rather than a decreasing one. And I think maybe I'd go as far to say that post-World War II international framework, perhaps even the Refugee Convention itself, I think these are all things which are endangered by the direction of politics as it responds to the pressures of climate change in displacing people, and the relationship between the world being more connected than ever digitally, and the disparities in standards of living being more and more obvious to people across the globe. So I think you've got a perfect storm of circumstances which make people want to move so that they can have, you know, a chance at a dignified standard of existence. And you've got richer countries responding to it by saying, okay, well, what we're going to do is put up our own borders as hard as we can. And also where international law and domestic law makes it difficult for us to deport migrants or keep them at bay, we're just going to rip up those agreements. Now, obviously, the UK, because of Brexit and because of the sort of radicalization of the Conservative Party, we're a lot further down that road where, you know, scrapping the European Convention on Human Rights and, you know, opting Britain out from that agreement is dominant within the Conservative Party. It doesn't seem to me to be the case that Irish politics is anywhere near that far. This idea that, well, hang on, if what we want to do collides with how judges are interpreting the law, if it collides with the law, we're just going to make some new laws. And that, I think, puts the entire framework of asylum at risk, because what has happened now is that the principle of seeking asylum, that it doesn't matter how you get here, will assess your case on its merits and grant you asylum, whether or not you need, you know, we'll grant you asylum according to if you need it. That's being jettisoned in favour of, well, we're going to have this very small number of places available to people, and we'll be selective which countries we'll let people claim asylum from. And as for the rest, we're going to give you no option but to come here through irregular means. And then when that happens, we'll call you an illegal immigrant and we'll try and shunt you back to the last country that you are in. You know, Britain seemed to be, you know, somewhat exceptional in terms of European politics in the last few years. And now I think it's very much going to become the norm.
Well, there were other European countries that sort of were looking at a similar returns scheme. I do think that the UK is sort of furthest along in that process compared to any other EU country. But yeah, I agree with you. I think this is going to be a big issue in the coming years and even the coming decades. And we will be returning to it, of course. For now, let's go on to our next story. Mayoral and local elections will be taking place across much of England and Wales this Thursday. It's widely expected that Labour will make major gains, but there's one race that could cause an upset for Keir Starmer's party. For the first time, a mayor will be elected for the North East Combined Authority. And hoping to win that election is Jamie Driscoll. He's the current independent mayor of North of Tyne. Driscoll quit Labour after the party blocked him from running on their ticket of mayor for the North East. But it now appears Labour may come to regret that decision. Recent polling by More in Common shows that Driscoll is pretty much neck and neck with Labour's candidate Kim McGuinness, who leads the race by just 2 points. It's what they call a statistical tie. Driscoll's campaign for the North East has focused on a pledge to deliver more and better jobs, take buses into public control, and a vision for a Green New Deal. He's also said he'll fight the two-child benefit cap. That's a Tory policy that's increased child poverty and which the Labour Party has said it would keep. And according to More in Common focus groups, Driscoll has also benefited from the perception he offers voters an alternative to centralised Westminster politics. And that's a theme he put forward in this recent campaign video.
It's hard to trust political parties. They keep breaking the promises and twisting their words. What you can trust is a track record. I said I'd back the Northumberland line from Newcastle to Ashington. I have, and it opens this summer. I said I'd create jobs, and I have, by the thousand. I said I'd go to London and get more money for the North East. And we now have the best funded devolution deal in England, over £6 billion. I've not put a penny on council tax, and I've claimed £0 in expenses, ever. We've had enough of career politicians. I was 48 before I was elected. I'm an engineer. Fixing broken systems is what I do. Vote for me, an independent mayor. I don't tell any party line, and I'll put the North East first.
I really like that line. He was 48 before he was elected, and that, you know, he had a proper career as an engineer. Because, you know, Aaron Bastani talks about this more than I do, but, you know, lots of people who their whole life has been in politics. I think, you know, people do like it when someone has had a proper job before they went into politics. So I think going into politics later in life should sort of be seen as a sort of asset in more situations than it currently is. Jamie Driscoll explained more about some of his plans when he was interviewed by Navarra Media's Moya Lovian-McLean earlier this month.
Trust in political parties is around 12%. And actually, that was from September, October last year. It'd be even lower now, post-Gaza. That's not something that any mayor can fix. And I think you'd be foolhardy to think that you're going to change the Westminster political system as a mayor. There are no legislative powers particularly that a mayor would want or need. What is required is control of the finances. So the only way we're actually going to make serious progress is to just move outside that paradigm. That's why I want to control the transport system, so I can start to use the powers available to bring in pension investment, and we can have it as a publicly owned system and not dependent on central government. But if you get that transport system right, that touches people. Because when you're talking about job creation, unless you've got one of those jobs, you don't know about it. And you start to bring the buses back under control, you integrate it with the metro, you make the fares free for everybody 18 and under, and you get them all on their public transport account, then that's meaningful to their lives. If you go out there and start talking about theories of government, honestly, you're not going to get much engagement, no matter how much energy you put into it. But you start affecting people's ability to get around to see their mates to get jobs, and they're using that service, that's when they'll say, actually, this is good.
That's a clip from a longer documentary by Moya, which you can check out on our YouTube page. And very interesting, all on devolution. I mean, it's titled, Could This Save the North of England? I do recommend checking that out. Now, interestingly, as well as voting intentions, the More in Common poll also asked people for their policy priorities when it came to a mayor. Now, top of the list with 42% was reducing crime and antisocial behaviour. Regenerating local high streets was next with 28%, and improving public transport was third with 23%. Ash, so a very close race for the northeast of England mayor. I suppose with those priorities, might we be seeing sort of Jamie Driscoll coming out and talking a bit more about crime and antisocial behaviour in the next couple of days?
Well, it's kind of the Aaron Bastani political platform, isn't it? Number one, you've got crime and antisocial behaviour. Number two, you've got regenerating the high street. You know, our dear colleague has been talking about that for quite some time. I mean, something that's very, very interesting about this particular race in the Northeast, it's basically a statistical tie at the minute between Jamie Driscoll and his Labour rival, is that one, it could very well come down to a matter of just, you know, a few hundred votes, right? Really a handful in political terms. And two, when you look at the More in Common polling, Jamie Driscoll is peeling away more 2019 Conservative voters than his Labour rival have managed to. So because obviously he was previously a Labour mayor, they kicked him out of the party for sharing a platform with Ken Loach. He's been able to take previous Labour voters along with him. He styles himself very much as a Green New Deal candidate. He's able to attract a significant portion of votes that would otherwise go green. And he's got a chunk of those 2019 Conservative voters. Now, I think when you're running as an independent and you've got a level of flexibility in terms of how you position yourself, it's easier maybe to hold together a quite diverse electoral coalition and speak to two audiences who, you know, ordinarily really do want different messaging. So a young audience, very, very concerned with climate change, and an older, more conservative audience whose, you know, top priority is crime and antisocial behaviour. I think that that kind of agility is trickier for politicians who are tied to a party. Obviously, there are certain things which will benefit the Labour candidate. Number one is postal votes. Postal votes tend to break towards the two major parties. And secondly, there's just a lot more in the way of resources for a Labour candidate to draw on, so they can really bring in the big guns. But it's a much tighter race than I think most people would have predicted at the beginning of this campaign season. And it's certainly an interesting one to watch. There may, of course, be other independents standing against Labour candidates in the general election, and I imagine they'll be keeping a close eye on Jamie Driscoll and how he does.
There's actually a lot of tight races this Thursday. So Sam Coates at Sky has just tweeted new YouGov polling. So when it comes to the West Midlands mayoral election, so the Conservative incumbent is on 41%. The Labour candidate, Richard Parker, is on 39%. So YouGov say that's too close to call. That's, again, a statistical tie. In Tees Valley, the incumbent, Ben Houchen, is on 51%. And Chris McEwen from Labour is on 44%. Again, YouGov say Houchen only ahead by the slimmest margin, because, you know, there are margins of error there. So it could be a very interesting night. Lots of the big mayoral races absolutely neck and neck. If those two Tory candidates do retain those mayoralties, I think that will be sort of a vindication maybe of these mayoral systems, because it will mean that there's a large personal vote for these people, because obviously the Tories are completely tanking in the polls. If the swings were just in line with people's voting intention for a general election, both of those people would absolutely, they'd have no hope. They'd be completely gone this Thursday. But the fact that they are sort of still looking, the Conservative incumbents look as if they could retain those seats, shows that, you know, there must be some sort of personal popularity that they have, or personal loyalty, let's say. Let's go on to our final story. LBC host Sangeeta Maizker has vanished from the station's airwaves, and no one knows exactly why. She last appeared on the station on the 14th of April. That was the day after Iran mounted its missile attack on Israel, which was in response to Israel having bombed its consulate in Syria. And on that day, Maizker conducted this interview with Israeli government spokesperson Avi Hyman.
What Israel did by taking that action against Iran was escalate what is already an incredibly fragile situation.
Sangeeta, that's an outrageous framing of the reality.
It's not outrageous framing. I've just been speaking to somebody who is a diplomat to Iran from the UK government. That's not an outrageous framing of it. What Israel did was strike what is considered in diplomatic circles the sovereign territory of Iran, whether we like it or not. No. And there was undoubtedly going to be a blowback. So did Israel game out what was going to happen next?
Firstly, I'm not going to speak directly to that strike. What I can say definitively, and this is why it's outrageous, I can say definitively is that that wasn't an embassy, it wasn't a consulate, it wasn't any type of diplomatic mission.
That's what Iran says.
So would you like to copy and paste?
Are you suggesting every single news organization in the world has got that wrong?
No, I'm suggesting that the Iranians have an interest to say that that was a diplomatic mission when we know definitively it wasn't. okay? Because they then want to give you the response that you've just copied and pasted, with all due respect.
Sangeeta Maizka's framing of the situation was not outrageous, as the spokesperson said, but Maizka hasn't been on LBC since. The Metro newspaper has approached both LBC and Maizka for comment, though neither has said why the host is off air. Listeners, though, are drawing their own conclusions. A change.org petition to reinstate Maizka was launched last week, and it's already gained over 18,000 signatures. Politicians have been demanding answers too. This was from Labour's John McDonnell. Sangeeta Maizka serves as a beacon of fair and balanced professional journalism. This decision smacks of censorship. And he says, reinstate Sangeeta Maizka to her position at LBC. Dawn Butler also commented, genuine question, LBC, where is Sangeeta Maizka? And you see that hashtag actually had quite a lot of tweets on it. And Lindsay Hilsum, who is a very respected journalist from Channel 4 News, said, worried about the unexplained disappearance from LBC of Sangeeta Maizka. She's a brave, principled journalist and an excellent broadcaster. Listeners will be missing her. What's the explanation? Others have been crowdsourcing clues. Social housing campaigner Kwejo Twenboa posted this. I've received a message from someone who I'll keep anonymous. They say Sangeeta disappeared from the LBC schedule. Producers were told no one will notice she's gone. But if people are to ring in to say she's fine, if this is true, it's vile. It'll now be down to LBC to confirm or clarify. Now, there have been at least a few signs of life from Sangeeta Maizka. Last week, she had this exchange with a fan. So someone says, hope you're okay, Sangeeta, you missed. And then Sangeeta says, I miss you all too. Maizka hasn't posted on Twitter since, but 4 days ago, she posted this to her Instagram account. Now, if you don't know, and I certainly didn't, that's a section of Verdi's Requiem called The Day of Wrath. And alongside it, Maizka wrote, quote, it's a beautiful reminder, whoever we are, whatever station in life, in the end, all should be judged on their honesty, authenticity, and actions. Ash, what do you think is going on here?
Whatever station we're at in life, eh?
I didn't even clock that. That's good.
I think there's a little bit of coded messaging going on there. Also on Sangeeta Maizka's Instagram was a photo of a flower bed and that was captioned gardening, ... leading some to speculate whether or not she'd been placed on gardening leave. I mean, the thing that I would like to point out is that the Israeli government spokesperson who she was interviewing, Avi Hyman, is, even by the standards of Israeli politics, really quite extreme. So in 2005, he was interviewed and he said, when handed the Temple Mount by miraculous means, we froze and watched as our apologist leadership handed over the keys to the Muslim enemy. So of course, he's talking there about the Israeli government who negotiated the Oslo Accords. Later, in a interview that was conducted with someone who was doing their PhD, he was asked if all the land of Israel was sacred. He said, when asked where the border should be, it clearly says in the Torah that Israel should go from the Euphrates to the Nile, and then it has to be. So this is someone who believes in a picture of Israeli expansionism that goes far beyond the occupied Palestinian territories, right? The Euphrates to the Nile is an awful lot of land. And this is someone who, you know, was being interviewed by Sangeeta Maizka, a Israeli government spokesperson. This man is an extremist, quite frankly. Those are very extreme positions to hold. She put to him completely legitimate questions where she said, well, look, the bombing in Damascus, it's an embassy compound. In diplomatic circles, that is considered the sovereign territory of another state. And if that was considered biased, well, then talking about international law, that's biased. There's then no definition of bias which, you know, can hold the sort of collectively agreed framework of international law is meaning anything anymore, because, you know, if Israel says that's bias, then so it is. I mean, it's just a way of completely chucking out of the window any kind of basis for journalistic interrogation. And it's really quite worrying if that is indeed the reason why she's been taken off the air. Of course, we can only speculate in the silence of LBC and Sangeeta Mishra, but the timing does sound quite suspicious, doesn't it?
When it comes to this, sometimes someone's like tweeted something, you know, unwise, and you know, obviously they shouldn't lose their job, but you can sort of see how there's sort of this weakness that someone inside the organization could exploit if they wanted to get rid of them anyway. But being, as we say, we can't confirm what's happened here, but being put on gardening leave, perhaps for having asked a diplomat a sort of difficult question, that's completely bizarre. But we have seen it before. So Mehdi Hassan, he seems to have been sort of let go from MSNBC for a tough interview of Mark Regev. Now, again, he didn't say anything untrue. He just gave Mark Regev a tough interview. And then within a couple of weeks, he was out. He was off air. So we are in a very, very strange situation. If not only are you not allowed to say sort of stuff about Israel which might offend certain people, now that's sort of the debate which we're used to. Oh, you think Zionism is bad, therefore you're an anti-Semite. That's the kind of discussion that we're used to people having. Or people doing, you know, I think unwise things like comparing Israel's actions to the Nazis, things which, you know, I think are best avoided. But we're very used to that sort of discourse. But this idea that asking a politician tough questions means that you risk your job. I mean, Ash, that is really quite chilling, isn't it?
This is exactly it. What we're seeing here are the various ways in which the doctrine of Israeli exceptionalism plays out through our politics and our media in this country. Now, there are reasons for that, about what's perceived to be in Britain and America's geopolitical interests, this idea of Israel being a outpost of Western interests in the Middle East. That's something which is shaped our foreign policy in relation to Israel for very many decades. But it's also something which has been absorbed and ruthlessly implemented through media organizations as well. It's this idea that the standards don't apply to Israel. And when you do sort of uphold them in relation to Israel's military activities, its domestic politics, that is, you know, unforgivably partial, right? It's totally biased. It's an illegitimate line of questioning. And I think that now there are wider sources of information for people, right? People get a lot of information on social media. People are able to access news sources like Al Jazeera. That doctrine of Israeli exceptionalism is coming under significant scrutiny from audiences which are politically engaged with what they're getting from the media. People consume a lot of media without trusting it very much. And I think that it puts media organizations that hope that they could get away with this kind of, you know, wildly unethical policing of its editorial lines, according to what's in Israel's best interest, it's harder for them to get away with that now than it used to be.
Even if you think a question is misjudged, you know, like who was it that asked? I think it was Angela Rayner. She was asked, "Would you nationalize sausages?" Now, I think that's a stupid, stupid question. But that person got promoted, and I don't, you know, obviously they shouldn't have lost their job for asking that question. And by the way, Sangeeta Mishra's questions were very good, as were Mehdi Hassan's. This was, by the way, the legal dispute is it was an annex to a embassy, right? And the embassy, 100% Iranian sovereignty. The annex seems to me there is some legal dispute. Lots of people say it is their territory. Some people clearly claim it's not. But either way, it's right next to the embassy. You can look up a picture of it. There's this building that's been bombed, that's collapsed, and right next to it is the official Iranian embassy. Now, it's a consular building, so under most people's understanding, that makes it the sovereign territory of Iran. But either way, this is the idea that you shouldn't ask about the provocative nature of bombing an embassy or a consulate building, I mean, just seems completely bizarre to me. Thank you, Ash, for joining me tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope you dislodged that bread.
I think I dislodged that sort of about halfway through the third story, I think. So I've been able to move my mouth freely for a little while now. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. Come back tomorrow for another stream from 6 p.m. You've been watching Novara Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Novara Media. Go to novaramedia.com/support.